This episode of the Good Health Podcast is brought to you by W Wellness, my go-to online store for practitioner-quality supplements. W Wellness is all about quality you can trust. Every product is carefully curated, third-party tested, and made in therapeutic doses. So you know you're getting exactly what your body needs without the fillers or the fluff. To help you get started, I've put together a free nutritionist-recommended supplements guide with my top picks for different health goals, all available from W Wellness. And of course, you can use my code Nicole20. You can download the guide right now for free via the link in the show notes and start building your supplement toolkit with confidence. Now let's jump straight into this week's episode.
Welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Good, a certified functional medicine practitioner, registered nutritionist, and author. In this podcast, we delve into the world of energy and immune health and wellness with positivity, from optimal health and energy to stress and burnout, right through to immune conditions such as thyroid and autoimmune disease. We deep dive into functional medicine, nutritional medicine, and lifestyle medicine, as well as the personal stories of our amazing guests, from Olympians to famous faces and guest experts from all different parts of the health and wellness world. It's time to stop letting your health hold you back and become the optimal version of you. Don't forget to come and join the conversation on Instagram at good_health, that's G-O-O-D-E, or visit the website nicolegoodhealth.com to find out more.
Welcome back to the Good Health Podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, and today we're exploring one of the most fascinating areas of longevity science, the lessons we can learn from the world's blue zones. These are the regions where people consistently live the longest, healthiest lives, places like Okinawa in Japan, Sardinia in Italy, and Nicoya in Costa Rica. But what is it that makes these communities so unique? Is it their diet, their lifestyle, their mindset, or something deeper? And how can we bring these insights into our own modern routines, kitchens, and supplement cupboards? To help me unpack all of this, I'm joined by someone who truly lives and breathes the concept of longevity through nutrition and lifestyle, registered nutritional therapist, educator, and longevity expert, Belle Amat. Belle is a dedicated registered nutritional therapist with a Bachelor of Science in Nutritional Medicine. She combines academic rigor with creative flair to better inspire health and well-being. Her background in education and passion for human connection infuse her practice with empathy and effectiveness. Belle offers a comprehensive range of nutrition-based services, functional medicine testing, health workshops, and courses. Currently, Belle is working with the platform W-Wellness, supporting the brand with research and co-hosting live events. She is also a senior lecturer with the College of Naturopathic Medicine. Longevity is Belle's specialism. She enjoys nothing more than exploring how to apply insights from long-lived populations to modern lifestyle. Belle hosted the Longevity Kitchen for many years in Sussex, which involved creating plant-based meals in community settings to inspire diners with lessons from the Blue Zones. Menu design for similar events remains one of Belle's passions. Let's jump straight into today's episode. Okay, Belle, thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on the podcast. Today, we're talking about Blue Zones, which, for those who don't know, are these areas around the world where people live sort of significantly longer, healthier lives, reaching that kind of 100 years old. Also, the bit that I find very interesting as well is also remarkably low rates of chronic disease. And I think that rather than, you know, we always talk about it just in terms of age, but actually the lack of chronic disease, I think, is also equally important and equally interesting. And we're talking about places like Okinawa in Japan, Sardinia, Ikaria, aren't we? Nicoya, Loma Linda. There's quite a few of these areas. What fascinates me in these communities is they really weren't trying to be wellness cultures. It's not something that they actively did. It's a lifestyle that is there naturally that we have found. And longevity kind of emerged naturally from the environment and the diet, the movement, the social structure. So for everyone who is new to the concept, who hasn't heard sort of about blue zones, can you just tell us a little bit more about them? What defines a blue zone? What are those sort of key factors that researchers have found in these regions that they've, you know, that they've got in common?
Okay, it's a great question. And Nicole, thanks for having me along today. It's my favorite topic. So totally delighted to be here discussing this with you. So I think you summed up quite nicely there in terms of what the Blue Zones is all about. It's not simply about the geographical areas where people are living for a long time. It's about the low incidence of chronic disease. And that's really important because when I'm discussing this topic with people, they will often say, you know, do we want to live a long time? And my answer to that is, well, actually, if you could see how these centenarians are living, so active mentally and physically, then yes, actually, I think it would be fantastic to be over 100 years old when we're living in this way. Now, you're right there with the areas that you pointed out. We've got Ikaria, which is a Greek island, Loma Linda in California, bit of an anomaly there because that's about the Seventh-day Adventists. There's an area, a cluster of hilly villages in Sardinia. And then there's Okinawa, which interestingly has been delisted recently because of the high levels recently noted of type 2 diabetes and other chronic diseases, which is sad, but also points to the fact that we can look back through history and understand what happened in the past, as well as looking at what's going on now.
And maybe that's that future, the sort of the modern world is finally starting to hit some of these areas and they are becoming more industrialized, modernized. You know, it's like there's more of that maybe going on in some of these areas.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, that's leading the critics to kind of discredit these areas. Whereas what I feel we can do is we can still look back, for example, at Okinawa, what happened through the 1950s? How did people live their lives? What kinds of foods were they eating then? Now, back to your question, Nicole, is what are the shared features? Now, the researchers, so led by Dan Buettner, who's an American explorer, also writes for the National Geographic, they have put together the Power Nine. So this makes it easy for me to answer your question there, because there are nine shared features that really stand out in these areas. So one of them is natural movement. We've got plant-based diet, but that's not about veganism. It's about the majority of your foods on your plate being plant-based, organic, seasonal, moderate amounts of alcohol. And we're talking really moderate here, not in Loma Linda, but a shared feature in the other areas. Important there to point out that this is alcohol that is locally produced with very few of the man-made synthetic chemicals that you'd see in the kind of alcohol we drink over in the West. Family first is a key feature. Sense of purpose. So in Okinawa, we'd be saying ikigai, plan de vida in Costa Rica. So sense of purpose, I think, so important. We wake up in the morning, what inspires you to get out of bed? You know, this doesn't need to be that we are aiming to be a Nobel Peace Prize winner. It could be something really simple, like I'm looking after my grandchild or I'm contributing to the community. But it's just about understanding what you're all about. And then there's a very important one. They're all important, but this is probably, I feel, the most relatable one to the Western world, is how we manage our stress. Downshifting, like that phrase that's popularized by the Blue Zones research. Also, moderate calorie intake, 80% full. Fantastic phrase they use in Okinawa, Hawahachi Bu, right at the beginning of a meal, meaning just eat until you're comfortably full, 8 parts full. And then we've got faith, and a focus on community and finding your tribe. So a wonderful array of different areas there.
When we sort of talk about these things, people instantly go to, oh, what's the diet? But actually, when you look at all of those pillars that you've mentioned, yes, the diet's important. It's an important part of it, but it's one small part of that whole picture. You know, there's a lot of those things are lifestyle things rather than being dietary, you know, nutrition based.
Very true. And I think it's super important to point this out, because the diet is a great factor in the Blue Zones. However, anybody could eat like that, but does it mean that everybody who eats like that is going to live a long time? No, because we could be incredibly stressed. We could be suffering from insomnia. We could be socially isolated. And the diet's just going to be a really small nudge in the right direction in those circumstances.
Yeah. It's actually interesting. On the first page of my book, one of the questions I actually ask the reader is, what would you choose? Would you choose to live to 100 but be sick for the last, you know, 40 years of your life? Or would you rather live to 80 and be well until you're 80? And that is something that you sort of picked up on there, is, you know, people sort of say, well, do I want to live to 100? And it isn't just about age. It's how well are we living? It's that longevity picture. And we often talk about longevity in functional medicine. We talk about it through the lens of mitochondrial health, inflammation, so that nutrient signaling. We talk a lot, mTOR, autophagy, AMPK. We talk a lot about it. Yet in the Blue Zones, these sort of pathways that we talk about in functional medicine, they're influenced not kind of by, you know, biohacking that has become a big thing around here, or, you know, supplements, but really by that kind of lifestyle and environment, those natural things that are around. So how do these traditional lifestyles activate those longevity mechanisms on that cellular level? You know, are there any particular behaviors or, you know, nutritional patterns that really stand out from that scientific perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question because these people are just simply living their lives. And this is what I love most about the Blue Zones. They're not doing anything crazily scientifically driven. They are just living their lives. And this is working on a cellular level for them on many, many different bases. So let's just pick a few of those apart. So one of the things I really like to talk about when I'm working in groups, on retreats, etc., is the hormetic effect. So when we think about hormesis, we're redefining that feeling of stress. Stress can often feel like a negative thing. But when we are living in a way where we're slightly mildly challenging our body by, for example, in the Blue Zones, they eat moderately and they exercise consistently, which at times is going to lead to calorie deficit. They also eat high amounts of polyphenols, flavonoids, the types of compounds which mildly trigger the body into a situation in which they're triggering autophagy. They are elevating the amount of endogenous antioxidants that are produced, which is going to help with detoxification. And this is just by living their lives quite naturally. Something else I feel like we can touch on here is the gut microbiome and the metabolites. So by having a very fiber-rich, high prebiotic diet, without buying anything other than the foods that they're consuming, such as beans, oats, rice, etc., they are nurturing their microbiome, which is going to lead to a higher level of short-chain fatty acids, having effect on the immune system, metabolic effects, epigenetic effects. So there's all these very subtle lifestyle habits that are enhancing their ability to live well into their later years.
Yeah, I want to just dig in a little bit more because something that you said, I think it was in the first question, we talked about how consistently across all those Blue Zones, it is a predominantly plant-based diet. And I think as soon as you say this to somebody, somebody automatically thinks, as you said, you know, vegan, vegetarian. And actually, it's they're not vegan, they're not vegetarian. What we're talking about is lots of fiber, lots of legumes, vegetables, also very little processed foods, which I think is important as well, because the plant-based diet is really what they're talking about is just whole foods. You know, they do have sort of goat's milk, fish, meat, you know, they those diets are quite abundant in those, but predominantly plant-based. In, you know, in functional medicine, we talk often, you've just talked there about, you know, things like phytonutrients, the anti-inflammatory fats, the microbiome diversity, all those things you've just sort of touched on. How important do you think the dietary patterns are compared to the lifestyle factors, which we've kind of touched on? And also, what sort of specific elements of their diet do you think have the biggest influence on this sort of Blue Zone area?
I would say certainly the high amounts of prebiotic foods influencing the microbiome, absolutely. The olive oil content alongside the Mediterranean diet research, we can see how anti-inflammatory this is. I'd say the low quantity of meat is also superbly important there in terms of many things. Firstly, the effect that it's having on their microbiome, also on their digestive tract, also in terms of the quality of meat they're consuming really needs to be noted too. So they're not having ultra processed foods. They're not having meats that have been raised with hormones and synthetic compounds. So there's a lot of anti-inflammatory strategies going on here without them even trying, if that makes sense.
I think that's really important as well. And I think the fact that it is a natural thing as well to them. And again, like, you know, I mentioned that the processed food, you know, they're not going and buying meals from a supermarket in most of these places. I think as well, family plays into that too. You know, it is that sort of cooking for the family lifestyle. You know, they're all in the kitchen cooking together as a family, cooking from scratch. You know, we talk a lot about what to eat. We don't necessarily always talk about how we cook it or, you know, how we enjoy our food, how we sit and eat our food, you know, those sorts of things. And that's something that we really can take, I think, from the Blue Zones, even, you know, over sort of the actual, you know, what should I eat, is how they do it.
Absolutely. I think that's so true. And I do feel in the world of nutrition, we can get very focused on what we're eating And we forget to think about the pace that we're eating at. Are we eating when we are in our sympathetic nervous state, rabbit in headlights, I call it with my clients? You know, when we look at statistics in the blue zones, and going back to what sparked my interest in the blue zones initially, was I read a book called The Okinawa Way. Have you read that? It came out in the 90s.
I've not read it. I've seen it. I've heard of it.
Fantastic. What really struck me when I read that book was the statistics in there that compare the United States with Okinawa at that time. So back in the 1990s, this information was more relevant because we would still consider it to be a blue zone then. And the incidence of digestive disease, so acid reflux, IBD, IBS, all of these conditions which we consistently are supporting our clients with in the Western world, very little incidence of these, particularly in Okinawa. And we can put that down not just to the food that they're consuming, but this wonderful way that they're eating moderately and socially, as you brilliantly pointed out there. And I feel like when we sit down at the table and tell our children from a really young age that they're only going to eat until they're 8 parts full, what a wonderful gift to give a child. And actually, recently, I was working with a group of children. One of them was Japanese. And I really wanted to know if this was still a habit that happened in Okinawa. And it's not just an old wives' tale. It still happens. And she was very much brought up to believe that you only eat until you're comfortably full. So that reduces long-term incidence of things like gastric reflux. But also, I feel like when we're eating in a shared environment, in a calm shared environment, we're also emotionally supporting each other by the conversations we're having around the table. There's also a level of social accountability and shared norms. So we're teaching our children how to eat well. I do feel like that's a very, very important point alongside what we eat, is just really eating together and enjoying our time.
Yeah. And another aspect of that that I find particularly interesting is that meal timing and how that plays a role. Because I think in many blue zones, they eat their largest meal of the day earlier. So maybe lunchtime. They have lighter, maybe evening meals. There's often that kind of natural fasting window overnight without having to tell somebody to do intermittent fasting. And this mirrors some of those sort of metabolic benefits that we've seen in the research, particularly around like time-restricted eating, circadian rhythm, you know, those sorts of things. Do you think this kind of natural meal rhythm that they have, that sort of earlier eating, bigger meals earlier, more overnight rest, longer, I'm not talking, you know, days of fasting here, I'm talking sort of, you know, the overnight fasting. Do you think that's an important piece of that blue zone puzzle?
I think it's huge. I think it's a really large piece of the puzzle that we can really learn from as well, because it's simple once we change our habits and get the habits under our belts, let's say. Yep. But for me, eating earlier in the day really aligns with the chronobiology research, thinking about our circadian rhythms, the physiological benefits in terms of how these have been researched when we're leaving that really nice long overnight fast. So this could be 12 hours. And that's, I feel, very doable, even if we have been used to nibbling into the evening. And the benefits are wonderful. I'm thinking sleep here really jumps out at me. When we decide on our switch off point, I like to say to my clients, 7 p.m. is a great switch off point. We don't need to be eating after 7 p.m. And if we have a nice fasting window where we don't eat again until 7 a.m. or further into the morning, maybe we could extend that for 14 hours. We've got better glucose control. We've got better lipid levels. Our blood pressure's improved. Cellular repair pathways are also recalibrated. And the impact it has on our sleep is fantastic.
Yeah. And sleep is when, you know, when all that repair happens. It's, you know, if we're not sleeping, the body's not repairing. We're not getting that cellular repair. Before we continue, I want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsors at W Wellness, who have made this series possible. As you'll hear throughout today's conversation, longevity is truly built on the foundations of nutrient-dense food, movement, purpose, and community. But in the modern world, even with the best diet, it can be difficult to meet all of our nutritional needs. That's where targeted supplementation can really support us. The supplements mentioned in this episode are carefully chosen to complement a longevity-focused lifestyle. All supplements on the W Wellness platform are carefully created to be the best for efficacy and bioavailability. All the supplements mentioned today are linked in the show notes below this episode. You can find them all on w-wellness.co.uk. And as a listener of the Good Health Podcast, you can enjoy 20% off your order with the code NICOLE20. So if you're ready to bring a little bit of Blue Zone wisdom into your daily routine with modern science-backed support, head to w-wellness.co.uk and explore the collection. Now let's get back to the conversation. You know, talking, you know, you're moving sort of with the sleep, we're moving on to that sort of lifestyle picture there. And another one that you've obviously touched on at the beginning is movement. And I think I always like to call exercise movement when I'm talking to patients, particularly because I work with people with chronic illnesses. You know, exercise quite often does feel out of reach for them if they've not been well for a while. So I quite like referring to it as movement. And I think the Blue Zones are very good for that because they don't necessarily exercise heavily. You know, they're not going down the gym. They're, you know, maybe walking to the market every day, or they're gardening, or they're, you know, they live in a hilly environment. So they're just walking up and down hills every day. Or, you know, it's not necessarily gym-based fitness that we're more sort of in tune with in the Western world. It's actually more low intensity. And I think something you picked up on, it's consistent, which I think is really important as well. And it's quite functional movement as well. What can we learn from that in a modern context, and how can we kind of replicate that natural integrated movement into our daily lifestyles in the Western world particularly?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Nicole. And as you're talking that through in my head, I'm thinking shepherds, Sardinia, and the fact that I love the research. You know, the deeper you dig into the research, the more you are amazed by small things such as they've actually, Dan Buettner and his team, have looked into the incline of these shepherd villagers and how this aligns with longevity. So, you know, the steeper your hills, the longer you live. Okay, now that's just a very basic equation there. And as we've discussed, it's more than one section here. We've got to take into account all of these nine areas we've looked at. But what we can learn from looking at shepherds, is can we get an incline into our daily routine? And this does not mean that we need to be shooting off to the gym, getting in Lycra. And I'm totally with you there on moving away from the words exercise, gym, to movement, just gradual movement. What we can learn is that we need to prioritize incidental movement, and we need to bring this into our routines. Now, on a physiological basis, of course, when the body is recognizing that we require more fuel to exercise, it's improving the ability of blood glucose to get into your muscle cells. Fantastic. So it's improving our insulin sensitivity. Now, the next question there that you asked, which is a brilliant question, is so knowing this, how do we pull this into our day-to-day routines? A lot of us are office-based or chair-based. It might be that we're in our own homes, but could we set a routine where every 60 minutes we get up for a 5 to 10 minute break? If you're at home, maybe get the Hoover out. If you can find a stairwell, could we walk down the stairs and come back up again, thinking about the shepherds there? Could we design our environments a little bit so they're more conducive to incidental exercise? Could be a walking desk. Could be that you've got a lift in your apartment, but you choose to use the stairs. Could be that you're commuting to London, for example, and you choose to use the stairs instead of the escalator. It's just that kind of purposeful intent that we can bring into our lives. But also, your social life can be purposeful too. If you're meeting a friend for coffee, could that be you grab a coffee and then you walk? It's about planning. And I think it can be joyous as opposed to feeling like a chore, which the gym does sometimes, which takes me back to your initial thought on choosing the word movement as opposed to exercise.
Even just parking that little bit further away. And, you know, if you're going to meet a friend for a coffee, park a little bit further away and walk to the coffee shop. I think particularly important, like you said, for those of us, and I'm including us in that, for those of us who do sit at a desk for quite a lot, it is even more important. We've talked about the sleep, the movement. What about stress? Because I don't think we can talk about health in the modern world these days without talking about stress. I think that's probably something that hits pretty much everybody that I see coming through clinic. And many of these sort of Blue Zones have this sort of strong sense of purpose. They have quite a lot of community and things like that that help to reduce with stress. How do you see the relationship between stress resilience and purpose and longevity in these regions? And what do you think we're missing in this sort of, you know, fast-paced world that we're living in these days? That they're not, I mean, they are living a slower pace of life. That's sort of quite clear to see when you look at it. But what is it that we're missing? What do you think we could do differently?
It's a great question. And I think what we're missing is the ability to allow ourselves to relax. We wear the word busy like a badge of honor, and burnout is the next thing to come.
Yeah,
that's not a place we want to get to. So when I think back to when I was a kid in the 1970s, on a Sunday, We did absolutely nothing. What did you do on a Sunday, Nicole, when you were a kid?
Not much.
Exactly.
Always more relaxed. Sunday was always downtime. It was, you know, it was a quiet, relaxed family day. Sunday was always family day for us.
And I feel now we got so much information and so much access to events that we almost feel like we need to be doing something. And I think the best thing we could do is just allow ourselves to do nothing and enjoy the fact that we're doing nothing. And maybe doing nothing is something. And we should be able to say, I am doing nothing this weekend and feel very proud of that. I think that's what we're missing.
But don't you think as well that we say, I'm pulling myself up on this one, but a couple of weekends ago, somebody said to me, what did you do at the weekend? I was like, I did nothing. And I didn't do anything in the sense that I hadn't had any plans, but I didn't do nothing. Even though I said I did nothing, I actually still got my computer out. I still did a bit of work. I was still doing quite a bit of, you know, jobs and stuff. I didn't do nothing, even though in my head I did nothing because I didn't have plans. But actually, I had quite a productive weekend and got quite a lot done. And I think we do the way we talk about things sometimes as well. I don't think we're very good at doing nothing and being quiet and just having space and time anymore.
Yeah, true. And I think that's a good point. So I think what we need to do now we've got to this stage in our lives, we need to plan to do nothing, which involves perhaps journaling and writing a list of things that you're not doing. Turning your phone off so you're not going to check your phone for the whole day. Maybe have a day where we don't actually get dressed. A PJ day sounds fantastic. Important to recognize that we're doing too much. I think that's the first step we have to take. We are doing too much. How do we back off from it? How do we feel okay about it? It's interesting, isn't it? Because where I live, there's a big sauna phase at the moment and I absolutely love it. So I will take myself off to the sauna or take myself off for a meditation. But in order to get there, takes me 45 minutes to get back. So I am actually doing something in order to not do something. So so we're all guilty of it.
Yeah.
When in fact, sometimes I have to check myself and say, no, I'm not going to go to that meditation class because I can just have a slow walk. Maybe we need to make a list of things that are in our world, bringing down our stress mechanisms so that we can just have some downtime, engage our parasympathetic nervous system and just allow ourselves to do less as opposed to nothing. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we have to take, I've always enjoyed reading. And as a child, that's something I did. I've always read a lot. I still love reading now, but I find now that I will sit down, pick up a book, and quite often the book will be a work-related book. And this is a conversation I have with patients a lot. And so say, if you pick something like reading to do as something to relax, don't pick up a workbook. As soon as you start reading that, it instantly starts engaging your brain in work again. Because I will read it and I'll be like, oh, that's really interesting. And I should go and look at the science on that. And I should, you know, and I'll start making, even if I don't go and actually do the research, I'll start making notes on it. And then my brain is becoming active again and into work mode. And I do try and talk to sort of patients about this and sort of say, if you're relaxing, don't try and relax in your office. You know, if your office is where you've got your bookcase, go and get a book and go out of your office, get out of the office to read. Because I think just if we're sat in that environment where we work, we're naturally putting ourselves into work mode. And I'm guilty of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is why I'm very fond of walking. I'm not using that. I'm specifically avoiding the word hiking because hiking comes across as something that is requiring a lot of energy. Whereas when we are gently walking, particularly with a friend works well, then we can't read. We don't tend to be looking at our phones unless we're looking at Google Maps. But maybe we could challenge ourselves to do just some gentle walking. If we can get to the sea, to a forest, I'm thinking forest bathing here, and just having that real sense of downtime, then fantastic. But I feel like, 21st century, we have to plan to do nothing. We've just reached that point of productivity over relaxation or connection, and we need to recognize that and then backtrack.
Yeah. Another thing you mentioned there is the connection, and I wanted to talk a bit about that as well. Blue Zone communities are very good at having these multi-generational families, strong social circles. They share meals. They have this real sense of belonging to a community. And we've really lost community, I think, in the Western world. And from a biological perspective, we know that those social bonds, they reduce cortisol, they improve your immune function, they lower cardiovascular risk. What role do you think community plays in sort of the health outcomes that these populations in these blue zones are seeing? And how can we try and recreate that? And I mean, that might be difficult, but what little things could we do to try and recreate some of that and that sort of sense of belonging in a more modern life that we're living?
I think community is huge. I really do. And I think we can look at Loma Linda in California, where they live very much in a community setting and their meals are made together. They are socially connected all of the time. I feel like there's something we can really learn as well from Okinawa, where they have Maui groups. And I love this idea. So from a very young age, they're put into groups of around 5 or 6, and they are consistently meeting up, having things like discussions on books or potluck suppers, for example. And I feel like we can look through our diaries and ensure that on a number of nights per week, we've got some social occasions happening. Because when we feel socially connected and we found our tribe, it's reducing our feelings of social isolation. And there's a huge body of research about how loneliness affects longevity enormously. Again, we need to make a plan here. How many occasions per week are we socially connected? Could we create our own social groups, such as potluck suppers, book groups, for example? Find a tribe that is very aligned with your own feelings about life. Could we be volunteering something else that is conducive to longevity? So when we're feeling like we're giving back to society and we're feeling like we're in the right tribe, cortisol levels are a bit lower and we tend to have less incidence of chronic disease. So again, it comes back to planning, I feel.
And what about one thing we haven't touched on, we've not sort of mentioned yet, is expozones, this sort of total environmental exposures that we get that influence health. And, you know, blue zone populations, you did mention sort of sea and forests and things like that, but they do tend to live closer to nature. You know, they tend to have cleaner air, natural light, homegrown food, being a part of the natural world around them. How significant do you think that connection to the environment is and that connection to nature is?
Yeah, I think it's integral. Being in nature and how before we had EasyJet and Ryanair, and I'm thinking about Edwardian Victorian Britain, we used to head to the seaside for a healthy break, just to really stand by the sea. And when we stand by the sea or we're in a forested area, we naturally breathe. And I find that really quite fascinating. Our body is instinctively, when we're by the sea, taking in iodine, for example, different minerals. And then when we're in forests and we're in nature, it's also incredibly replenishing to take in these compounds that are coming off the trees. The critics of the blue zones will say, we can't possibly live like that unless we live in a similar situation, meaning a rural environment. But actually, I think we can learn from blue zones and think, okay, maybe I live in a center of a city. Can I make space on a monthly basis to find my way to the countryside and have some country air? Because it's incredibly rejuvenating to have that time. So I think it's pretty central. But I think it's really important that we don't feel like it's unachievable if we live in a city.
And, you know, you mentioned there sort of criticisms of the blue zones, and we've talked about obviously the benefits of it. But to keep the conversation kind of rounded, let's talk about some of the critiques that there are out there. You know, data accuracy can vary. Genetics can play a big role in things. And you know, people will sort of say, you know, is there a genetic component to the people that live in these areas? And the one you picked up on, which is, you know, not all habits can be replicated globally. It's difficult. What are some of the main critiques or sort of limitations that you've seen in the blue zone research? And how do you view them? What's your opinion on some of these critiques?
Oh, it's a great question. And there's, you know, as you say, there's many different critiques. The one that really stands out for me is that the blue zones are purely favorable genetic gene pools. So thinking about selection survivorship bias there. So are centenarians by definition survivors? Is this just about genetics? Well, I feel like the way that we can understand this and understand that, no, absolutely it's not, is by looking at the Danish twin studies. Just an amazing, fantastic piece of research long-term studies on twins' health and lifespan. So from the 1980s onwards, researchers have been comparing identical and fraternal twins and the environmental influences on them to understand how much of our ability to live well into our later years is about genetics and how much is about environment. And based on this research, we can see that around only 25 to 30% is about genetics. So you've got about 75% power. I like to use this piece of research when I'm talking to my clients who might be concerned that they've got a chronic disease in the family, but we've actually got the reins in our hands of 75% chance of living really well if we look at other factors such as diet, exercise, etc. So I'd say that's my favorite critique that's very easy to pick apart. The other one that's absolutely fascinating is about age verification. So there's a lot of early critiques here which questions the records. Are the birth certificates of some of these centenarians actually real or not? Well, my feelings on that is, does it really matter? Because we can still see that there's a large body of people here that have lived to 100 or maybe almost to 100, that the actual number of 100 is not as relevant.
And the chronic disease levels are still lower, aren't they? You know, even if they're 90, the chronic disease levels are still lower, you know, so it's not just an age thing.
Yeah. So, you know, my view on all of the critiques really is that we can see the blue zones as extremely valuable, hypothesis generating. We can learn from it. We can understand it. We can learn from it and we can adapt. That's all we need to do. We don't need to live the life of the centenarian in Okinawa. We need to understand what we can do, pick five or six different elements of the blue zones, diet and lifestyle, and bring it into our lives.
Yeah. And I think, you know, on that note, what are some of your favorite kind of blue zone or blue zone inspired, you know, dishes, meals, or ingredients that you incorporate at home or that you would tell patients to incorporate at home?
I quite like to think about visualizing a plate. So the blue zones have created this really amazing blue zones plate where you're looking at your plate and you're seeing that around 2/3 to 3/4 of it is colored, plant-based, a diversity of different kinds of fibers here. So I'd be looking at things like black beans, you know, anything that's pigmented with that dark blacky purple color. We're thinking about polyphenols and the phytonutrients that are so, so important for keeping us healthy. Whole grains, nuts is a commonality. There's not a huge amount of exact commonalities in terms of food types over the whole five different blue zones because there's such different areas of the world. But nuts, handful of nuts on a daily basis, we've got to think about moderation here, is just incredible, absolutely packed full of nutrients.
And while these sort of blue zone places, they don't rely on supplements, they do get quite a lot from the natural environment around them, from the food. Modern life, you know, we have to accept that we do live in a slightly different world to some of these places. Modern life does sometimes demand kind of a bit of extra support and nutrients like the polyphenols, the omega-3s, you know, vitamin D, particularly where, you know, particularly if you're in England where we don't get that much sun. Which sort of supplements or nutrients do you feel align with that sort of blue zone philosophy and support a health span, I guess, in a way that kind of complements rather than replaces doing the nutrition and the lifestyle stuff? But which ones do you think complement the blue zone?
Complementing, I'm immediately drawn to thinking about high antioxidant foods and the types of foods that they have in the blue zone, such as I'm thinking in Okinawa, they use a lot of turmeric. So I feel like we can get turmeric from our diet, but it's also quite fun and quite useful to bring in a supplement, such as there's one that I use on the W Wellness platform by Fushi, and it's a turmeric liquid. And I put a teaspoon of it into my fresh apple juice in the morning. Just bringing in those lovely habits. There's resveratrol as well. I'm just thinking about the phytonutrients that we find in the blue zones. There is a resveratrol product that is a liquid. I'm laughing here because resveratrol's always something we associate with red wine. So at this point, lots of people will say, does that mean we can have red wine on a daily basis? That's where we get our resveratrol from. Well, we can, but resveratrol, you can also buy in a supplement. And I like to make a mocktail out of it, particularly at this time of year, by putting it with some pomegranate juice. Medicinal mushrooms, I would also use in terms of thinking about the high level of antioxidants that we're getting in seasonally produced homegrown foods that we would be eating if we lived in the blue zones? Because I think that's quite a difference, isn't it? Is that we are buying shop-bought things when we are in the Western world. In the UK, we might be buying blueberries that have travelled from a very long way away. Are their phytonutrients as relevant as they would be if they were picked off the tree in Costa Rica or wherever they've come from? Well, absolutely not. And I think that's where supplements can come in. It's just bringing something in that's got a really powerful antioxidant hit, such as I like to use Hifastetera, medicinal mushrooms. I might sprinkle them into my over the top of my latte, or I might put them into a dip that I'm using. So it's about elevating the antioxidants, which I think we can be missing a little bit over here.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And as we think about sort of longevity, it's not, as we said, it's not just about our own lifespan. It's about the legacy that we create, the habits, the food culture you've talked about, sort of teaching children, and it's passing those lessons on, I think, for the next generation. What do you think the Blue Zones can teach us about that sort of intergenerational health, and how can families start to look at those principles together? What sort of things should we be teaching the kids?
I do feel like what we miss over here is the recognition that spending time with our families, family first, one of the power nine that we talked about at the beginning of our talk, is so, so important. So older people in the Western world can feel a little bit pushed aside because they're very much integrated into the younger generational's kind of day-to-day living. And I feel like we can learn a lot from each other by sitting and cooking regular meals, learning about how to cook from scratch, and doing things together. This comes back to us thinking about movement. Could this be that we're gardening together? Could this be that we're walking and talking and sharing time? Also has effect on our stress levels. So the more time that we're listening to each other and valuing each other's opinions brings our central nervous systems down to a much calmer place.
I mean, I love that sort of intergenerational health that they have in the Blue Zones, and the idea that they do all still, you know, sit down as a family and everything like that. It's something that we've just lost so much, I think, in our day-to-day lives. And I love that they still sort of put so much power in that. Final kind of question for you. The Blue Zones really are that sort of powerful reminder that, as we said at the beginning, you know, it's not just what you eat. It's health is cumulative. It's like building up all these small things, these small daily rituals, these small, you know, moments like shared meals. It's not necessarily a protocol. It's a lifestyle and it's a way of life. If there's one simple, achievable change that you would encourage people to make today, so if somebody just wants to go away off the back of this and say, I'm just going to do one thing, what would be that one thing that you would encourage everybody to do that is in the spirit of, you know, Blue Zone living and lifestyle?
In the spirit of the Blue Zones, I would say my biggest tip is to just stop. Stop rushing, spend time, listen to yourself, listen to your own needs, push your self-care up to the top of the pile, and just consider life to be a marathon and not a sprint. With positivity.
I love that. I think that's great final words to leave everybody with. Belle, thank you very much for joining me today. I've loved this conversation. I think everybody else will as well. It's great to have a chat with you about the Blue Zones. Thank you for your time.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Good Health Podcast. Do share the episode with anyone you think it may benefit, and help us to spread the word on all things health and wellness by rating, liking, or subscribing to the podcast. If you want more, you can listen to more episodes on your favorite podcast app, or sign up to my newsletter for my favorite tips, tricks, health advice, brands, recipes, and more at nicolegoodhealth.com/newsletter. Have a lovely week. Don't forget to hit subscribe, and I'll see you on the next episode of the Good Health Podcast.